I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is Dr. Jessica Zitter, a national advocate for transforming the way people die in America. And now, join Shiva Schultz on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Dr. Jessica Zitter. Jessica Nutick Zitter, MD, MPH, is an expert on the medical experience of death and dying. Zitter is double boarded in the two medical specialties of pulmonary critical care and palliative care, a rare combination. She writes regularly for the New York Times and other publications and is featured in the Oscar and Emmy-nominated short documentary Extremis, now streaming on Netflix. Her book, Extreme Measures, tells the stories of patients and healthcare providers caught in a culture that does not easily acknowledge the reality of death, thus stripping people of their humanity at the end of life. Zitter's mission is to build bridges between patients and caregivers so patients can experience a life that ends well, even beautifully. So it's a real honor to have Dr. Zitter here with us.
Thank you all so much for having me. It's a tremendous pleasure to be here. So, you know, I speak in front of a lot of audiences about my work. And it's a real special pleasure for me to speak in front of a Jewish audience, because this is really where it all began for me. Okay, so I'm going to start by reading one of the chapters, the opening chapters of my book, and it's going to, I think, explain how I really got in front of the place of sitting in front of you today. There is a photograph of me in diapers, listening intently to my bear's leg through my father's black stethoscope. Descending from two generations of surgeons on my father's side, I yearned to join their club. My father, my grandfather, and a host of great uncles were scrappy doctors who prided themselves in their technical skills and calm in the face of death. Their patients honored them with a continuous holiday stream of wine, chocolates, and smoked fish. But it hadn't always been that way. Mine was a family of recent immigrants escaping the poverty and anti-Semitism of Eastern Europe. They came to Montreal to tend fruit stands, butcher stalls, and other small businesses, working late into the night and struggling to put bread on the table for their families. One of my great-grandfathers was a tailor. The other ran a small millinery store. Although they struggled, they gave everything they had to hoist the next generation up into the light. They would not be satisfied with a modicum of comfort and safety, but instead worked relentlessly to enable those of us coming after to become educated and respectable members of our new society. It took only one generation for that to happen. Of the eight sons born to my father's four grandparents, four became doctors and two dentists. So, you know, I'm going to show you a picture of my family tree. Kind of crazy. My father's great-grandparents at the top, all immigrated, and then you can just see the penetrants. They were immigrants from the shtetl. They had no formal education to speak of, but they produced this very highly trained flock of doctors. And on my mother's side, it really wasn't that different. So I have a feeling this isn't a very unfamiliar story to many of the people in this room. You know, they came here for new opportunities, a better life, a chance to contribute. It's the American, well, actually the Canadian, dream. And the new generation that emerged was almost a different culture from that which had brought them here. They were tall, well-nourished. They were educated. They were no longer the unschooled greeners that had brought them here, who couldn't speak English. They were experts. Professionals contributing to a better society. This is my grandfather, an OBGYN, who I'm going to tell you now, I know it's a little awkward and strange, but he delivered me. Think about that. my great uncle Harry, who was a surgeon in the Canadian Army during World War II, alongside General Montgomery. And he returned after the war from Europe, having learned the art of triage. And actually, as family lore has it, and I tried confirming this, and if anyone has any ideas of how I can confirm this, please let me know. Apparently, he started the first emergency room in Canada, which was at the Jewish General Hospital. And my Uncle Arnold in Jamaica, Queens. And of course, the biggest influence on me, my own father, the neurosurgeon. You can see, I had this fascination as a young girl. This was this desire to join this group of heroes, this family business. As I said, this phenomenon isn't unique to my family. The numbers bear it out. You know, in 2005, 2% of the U.S. population was Jewish, and 14% of the physician workforce was Jewish. So we really overrepresent in this profession. Now, what is this adoration of our doctors? You know, it's not just about achievement or professionalism or even assimilation. You know, I believe that it also comes from something a lot deeper. It comes from some ancient religious values that are embedded into our culture. You know, medicine wasn't seen as a profession, but as a calling from on high. I want to bring it home with another excerpt from my binder. From its inception, Judaism has venerated the practice of medicine. The Torah itself, the central core of its beliefs, glorifies the eradication of disease and the sanctity of life. God states in Exodus 23, "I shall remove illness from your midst." In Deuteronomy 7, we are reassured that Hashem will remove from you every illness. And the Talmud, which interprets the Torah's instructions into a code of laws for the Jewish people, formalizes this high value that we place on the work of life-saving, on the act of life-saving, and it states, whoever saves a life, it is as if he saved an entire world. Anyone who's saving in the act of saving a life is permitted to even break the laws of the Sabbath, some of our most sacred laws. In fact, it's required that any law that conflicts with life or health be broken. There's a phrase, he who asks questions sheds blood, in a tractate of our Jewish law. In other words, hesitation of any sort renders one complicit in the death of a person. And so the doctor was therefore introduced as God's agent for healing. You know, being a doctor was considered of communal importance, similar to being a rabbi. So, not only were they respectable, but they were actually sanctioned by God, an extension of God's arm. So, divine approval was nice, but there was more. There was something else that was, for me, even deeper. It was the pursuit of justice, one of our core values as a people. And I'm going to read you one more excerpt. This is a Canadian $20 bill. It was not about the money, at least not in my family. My grandfather's and my great uncle's practices were filled with working class and poor patients. There was a sliding scale for payment. My grandfather charged $600 to deliver the child of a wealthy person and $150 for someone in the middle class. The poor didn't pay at all. He was paid in cash, $10 at a time, or whatever someone could afford to pay. My uncle remembers the large wad of $10 bills in the top drawer of my grandfather's desk. There were times when my grandfather ripped up invoices of poor people, telling his secretary, "You can't send this." According to family lore, at his death, he was hundreds of thousands of dollars in arrears. My uncle Arnold, who became a family practitioner in Jamaica, Queens, cared mostly for poor and impoverished patients, and he received mostly fivers for his work. So, they were heroes, they were sanctioned by God, and they were mensches too. And I was sold. This profession was perfect for a nice Jewish girl. So what did I do? I decided to train in pulmonary and critical care medicine, which I consider to be the most heroic of the medical subspecialties. I wanted to be able to use machines and protocols and procedures to scoop people from the jaws of death and to help them. And I got my first job in Newark, New Jersey. It was my first real job. I'd worked at Kaiser for a little bit here after my fellowship. And I came in really guns blazing, always ready to insert a catheter or do anything quickly, put in a breathing machine if anybody was physiologically wavering. I was fast. I was efficient. I was eager. But something felt off. At the time, I didn't have words for it. Just this low-grade concern that for many of my patients, I was often hurting them more than I was helping. And I kept my concerns at a low rumble for the most part. It was really part of the collateral damage of saving lives, I thought. But there was a day when it all came to a head for me. It was 2003, 11 years after I graduated from medical school. And I was attending in this new hospital in Newark, New Jersey, level one trauma center, middle of the action. Patient in room 5 was really seriously ill. She had metastatic breast cancer, and her kidneys had just started to fail. She'd been on chemotherapy for years, continuing to advance. And she was now sick enough for the ICU and rapidly deteriorating. Her acid levels in her blood were rising very quickly. Her potassium levels were rising very fast, very dangerous. It was bad. It was really bad. The team asked me, can you please insert a dialysis catheter so we can immediately do some dialysis and try to clean her blood? Made total sense to me. Correct those labs that are out of whack. Give us a little bit of time to find another miracle drug that hadn't been tried yet. So I informed the husband about the risks. I checked them all off, pneumothorax, bleeding, hemorrhage, infection, and I talked about how we would deal with each one. I did say there were risks. He signed the consent form and nervously went off to the waiting room as I got ready to help his wife. And they brought the hemodialysis machine right up there. They put us to the top of the list, put it right next to the room. As soon as we got that catheter in, the plan was to connect and start dialysis. As I was getting ready to insert the needle, I felt somebody watching me from the door. And it was this nurse, Pat Murphy. Pat ran what was called at that time, euphemistically, the family support team. Now, it was to become the palliative care team many years later. This was 2003. Palliative care was not officially a subspecialty until 2008. So we didn't even know how to spell it, let alone know what it did. And this family support team had actually won an experimental grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation that only 4 hospitals in America won. It was that they won it in 2002. About 460 applications had gone in for this grant. And this grant was enhancing communication in the intensive care unit. That's what the intention was. And by total random chance, I happened to be working in one of the 4 hospitals that had won this grant. And Pat was one of the grant fundees and had started this family support team. So honestly, I didn't really know who these people were. I didn't know what they were doing. It was a whole different kind of thing to have somebody talking to my patients, not going through me. They would go in, they would talk, they would ask me why I hadn't talked about prognosis with this. I thought, hey, wait a minute, my communication's pretty good. I'm a good talker. And I kind of took what they said with a grain of salt. And now Pat is standing in the doorway with her arms crossed, her foot tapping, and she is furious. And she puts her hand up to her face like this, and she says, get me the police. They're torturing a patient in the ICU. Wow. Okay. Not what I ever expected to hear. But it all came together for me in that moment. Those 11 years of that subtle, rumbling moral distress. I understood in a moment what had been bothering me over that past decade. I understood, Pat, as she put into gestures, what I knew in my heart to be true. That, one, I was doing something that was not going to help this woman. It was going to cause pain, fear, suffering. It was going to keep her husband away from her in her final hours. But it wasn't going to change anything, and I knew that. And number two, and maybe more importantly, I was doing something that I would not have done to myself. Where was that compassion, that love of justice that had drawn me into medicine in the first place? What was I doing? Now, to my shame, I will admit that I put that catheter in that day. I really honestly couldn't see a way out of it at the time. And the catheter did not, as I mentioned, save that patient's life, but it changed mine. And that's why I'm here in front of you today. I saw the light. I had an epiphany. I became a convert, whatever you call somebody who has seen things in a new way, one that is sort of deeply spot on, consistent with your, with my deep values. And the day after this happened, I went to Pat. I lowered my confidence and my bravado, and I said to her, Pat, who had been my nemesis, by the way, will you mentor me? And Pat did, and Pat is still a mentor to me. She taught me about what I now call the end-of-life conveyor belt, where people are attached by default in a protocolized sequence to machines without real, deep, honest discussion and confronting of the truth, without talking about their preferences and values, with a machine-like efficiency that leaves the human behind. She opened my eyes to the unbelievable amount of untreated pain and suffering that goes along with the end-of-life conveyor belt. I had never been taught to prioritize that because for me, it was all about keeping the heart pumping and keeping the blood pressure up. And quite honestly, sometimes the things that you would use for pain and suffering may lower the blood pressure. And I throw them out the door if I'm prioritizing keeping that blood pressure up. And you can argue, I mean, I have one of my colleagues here, Dr. Raghav is here. You can argue there are moments where, but it has to be a conversation. These are very complicated decisions. You don't just assume that the heart pumping is always the priority. You have to have lots of conversations to understand what should the priority be here. And she also showed me that I really had no idea how to communicate with my patients, that they were so often, too often kept in the dark. And I justified it as maintaining hope. But honestly, I have to admit, I couldn't admit my powerlessness against death. I felt like it was a failure. And there were so many other reasons, which is in a whole other talk as to what would obstruct me from having that communication. But nonetheless, I was not communicating honestly and effectively with my patients. And so I became a convert to this new philosophy of care, this palliative, P-A-L-L-I-A-T-I-V-E, care. This new subspecialty which cares for the patient, the whole patient, not just the kidneys or other organs or diseases. And the thing about palliative care is that it works. Decades of data show us now, at least two plus decades of data, show us that patients with serious illness receiving palliative care almost always live much better than those without it. And honestly, there are many studies that show that they may live longer. So, since my epiphany, I've helped many patients and families get the kind of care that is aligned with their own preferences and values, and the result of what many of us would call a good death. A dignified, peaceful, and meaningful experience. So I became a zealot about this topic. I started writing nonstop, started with private journal entries, and then I started to get some pieces into local and national newspapers. And then I got a book contract with Penguin, which I hope you'll all read. It tells the stories of my own experiences, my colleagues, and my patients. I convinced a filmmaker to come into our hospital and to show the stories of these patients and families, and I hope you'll all watch that. It's on Netflix. And that's how I ended up in front of you all today, with a book, this movie, and a message.
You're listening to Dr. Jessica Zitter, whose book is Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And so now I work with many others, many in this room, for culture change, within and outside, not just within medical culture, but also outside of medical culture, in the community. It's hard work, this culture change. It's two steps forward and one step back every day. It's hard. Why? Because people don't like change, especially when that work is about facing difficult truths, some of the most difficult truths of all. The fact that we will all die. Okay, so here's the setup. Now, I want to talk about what I believe that Jewish culture has that can help us, the wisdom that I think we can draw from to do this better. Jew and non-Jew alike, by the way. Okay, many people say Jews do death well. We do. I agree with that. We have incredible rituals and communal support. But that's after someone has died. I don't think we do as well before someone has died. Like other Americans, we also have gotten seduced by this heroic promise of modern medicine, by this dream of A-team physicians who are out there with these miracle cures, these magic pills. This conveyor belt that's going to get us better. We, too, have fallen prey to the same fantasy of perpetual life that traps so many on the end-of-life conveyor belt. And we can do better. I think we can do much better. We can draw on our rich heritage of wisdom and stories to guide us through. For example, in the book of Genesis, we read about our forefather Jacob. And we knew that when he was to die, he made all of his preparations, all of the necessary preparations. He got his family gathered. He blessed his grandsons, Ephraim and Manasseh. He gave instructions on exactly how and where he wanted to be buried. And then, when everything was in place, he took a very peaceful last breath, and he died. His was a death on his own terms. He lived in autonomy and dignity right up until the very end. He's a model of a death that really is worthy of a forefather of our people, and frankly, of all of us. You know, in ancient days, preparation, like Jacob did, involved determining where you wanted to be buried, who you wanted to have around you as you died, the blessings for your offspring, and other preparations about the legacy that you wanted to leave. There's very little in our tradition to prepare us for today's array of technological wizardry. Instead, you know, whether doctor or patient, Jew or non-Jew, we have set aside our pragmatism and worshipped at the altar of technology. But let's again go back to the inspiration of our sacred texts to take a little bit of a clue about how we might want to be thinking about this technology, which is wonderful. And by the way, I'm not anti-technology. Well, I've saved lives with technology. This is not about being anti-technology. It's about using it in the most appropriate way for a given person, based on prognosis, reality, preferences and values, benefits and burdens. And that must be a process that's discussed with each patient and each family. It is not something that can be assigned to a conveyor belt. So, let's talk about this story. In the 13th century text, Sefer Hasidim, Rabbi Judah ben Samuel counsels us not to prolong the dying process. In those days, before breathing machines and CPR, his examples of life-prolonging interventions actually seem quaint today. They include the sound of wood chopping. How many people in this room have heard the story about the wood chopper? He says, tell the wood chopper to stop chopping if it's keeping someone from dying, if it's keeping someone stimulated so that they're not dying. He also says it is forbidden when someone is dying to place salt on the tongue. Because why? And my colleague is looking interesting. Because salt can increase the turgor pressure in the blood and possibly raise the blood pressure. It's like a presser in ancient days. So he said, do not do that if someone is dying. No wood chopping, no salt. But it was serious because this warning is repeated again 2 centuries later in the Shulchan Aruch, which is our most referenced code of Jewish law. These were serious prohibitions. And a passage in the Gemara later echoes this wisdom. Now, here is another story. It talks about the death of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He was in great pain, and his students were praying, his yeshiva buchers, praying and praying and praying for heavenly mercy to prolong his life. They prayed constantly at all hours of the day and night to keep him alive. I mean, it was a life support of sorts. But his handmaiden was distressed by his suffering, the stretching out of his death, and she quietly prayed instead for a peaceful death, for a peaceful end. And finally, she could take it no longer, and she went up to the roof, and she took this earthenware jar, and she threw it down from the roof. And the sound was jarring, and for a moment, the yeshiva bucher stopped praying, and he died. So, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi's soul was able to depart to its eternal rest. And so again, the story from these two things. So Jews are instructed, we are instructed to do everything possible to save a life. However, it seems we should not interfere or hinder the natural process of dying when it is happening. It goes against God's will. And yet, it's precisely what we do over and over again in intensive care units and hospitals around this country. And unfortunately, the world. So to summarize these three stories, they teach us profound lessons if we listen. Jacob shows us the importance of accepting and preparing for our deaths. The human preparations that Jacob made, but also the medical preparations. Do you want to be on a breathing machine? Would you want to be intubated? Would you want to have CPR and cardio? These are things that we are being counseled to do. Number two, hindrances to the natural dying process should be averted, as with our wood chopping and the fervent prayer for Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And number three, the idols of technology should not be worshipped. Just because we possess interventions that might keep a dying person alive for a little bit longer, it doesn't mean that we should use them. Stretching out death can be excruciating. I see Dr. Bhargava nodding. A couple thousand years ago, it was salt on the tongue. Today, it could be a ventilator. So I have an idea. When it comes to dying, let's tack on a few extra commandments. Accept death as a part of life, as Jacob taught us, and prepare for it early and thoughtfully. Don't worship the idols of technology. And don't hinder the dying process in a patient who prefers a natural death. And there's a couple more commandments for the physicians among us. Practice compassion by treating our patients the way we would want to be treated if we were the ones in that bed. And pursue justice by giving the people the information that they deserve and that we are not yet giving them. Okay, so laws are one thing. How about some rituals? We are a people of ritual. Our rituals have helped us through many difficult times. They remind us what's important, and they show us a way forward. We're already doing the death ritual part well. I really think we do Shiva, Shloshim, Tahara. I mean, all of these things are tremendous gifts to our community. But what about for the dying part? Again, it wasn't necessary in early days because people knew, they had this intrinsic knowledge of millennia of how to tend to dying patients, keep them as comfortable as possible, keep them at home, surround them with their families, basic human strategies. But today, we're caught off guard by death. We live in this culture that denies mortality. And as too often happens in these foreign places of the hospital, things happen without you realize, and all of a sudden, people are trapped in these cold and sterile institutions. Now, we also know, especially in places like San Francisco, how to invent new rituals. Right? Anybody? Orange on the Seder plate? Okay, so the story goes, right, in the 1970s, after a rabbi said that a woman belongs on the bima like an orange on a Seder plate. Well, many Jews, and certainly in my family, started putting oranges on our Seder plates. So here are a few ideas for some new rituals that could help us plan to live and die the way we want to. Okay. Anybody recognize these cards, by the way? Go Wish? Okay, good. So, by the way, gowish.org. Good reference to know about all. So here's some rituals. Maybe all Jewish couples should be encouraged by rabbis before they get married to go and play Go Wish before they get married in order to understand each other's views on death and dying. Maybe when we sit under the sukkah, we discuss what we want our own final season to look like. Maybe during Rosh Hashanah services, when we say Unatana Tokef, the prayer that reminds us that life and death are not in our control, that we don't know who's going to be here next year, maybe then we should be reflecting on that reality for ourselves and our loved ones and go home and prepare an advance directive. These rituals that I'm suggesting will help us have the kind of death that Jacob had, surrounded by our loved ones, all tasks, both material and otherwise, complete. They all fall under the category of what we call today advanced care planning, which, as I said before, requires planning for both the medical preferences that you have in context of your disease and your own personal values, but also the human preferences. All of those things I talked about, who should be there? Who should be coming to visit you? How will they find out? These are things that people don't think to plan for, but they're very important. Should your rabbi come and visit you in the hospital? So, I think this is all summed up best in Pirkei Avot, which is the Ethics of Our Fathers, a collection of wisdom from our sages. In it, Rabbi Eliezer teaches us to repent one day before your death. Now, the Talmud explains this to mean that a person should be in the process of tshuva, or repentance, every day of her life, since one never knows when the last day will come. And the message is really profound. You know, it reminds us again that death should always be part of our lives. And only God knows what our final day is going to be. We certainly don't. So in the context of that uncertainty, if we want to be prepared, fully repented, before our final breath comes, we must be at all times prepared for death. Spiritually, religiously, and practically as well. So I'm going to close now by reading from my own book about my own surprisingly too recent experience in reflecting on my own death. To me, in this profession, at its simplest level, heroism is acceptance of our own mortality. And that is where we all, doctors and lay people alike, must draw on our courage. I attended a conference called Mindfulness in the ICU at the University of California, San Francisco, several years ago. I was at once intrigued and baffled. At the time, the title of the conference struck me as an oxymoron. Can one be mindful in an ICU where every second counts? Should one? Taking even a moment to breathe or to reflect seemed a bit risky to me at that time. It was a day-long workshop, and I arrived at 8 a.m. After the attendees grabbed coffee and danishes, we were asked to take a seat in the main room. It was set up very differently from most conferences. The chairs in a large circle. Dr. Levy, the leader, introduced himself and then asked people to go around the room introducing themselves to the group. I was disappointed, although unsurprised, to find that physicians were in a significant minority. Most of the people attending were nurses, with a smattering of physical therapists, respiratory therapists, and administrators. Dr. Levy didn't look like a Buddhist, I thought. He looked like a doctor with a blue suit and tie and white cropped hair. The only thing that struck me as Buddhist was that he had removed his shoes. Unusual, but it seemed quaint and lent an atmosphere of authenticity to the experience. He smiled at the group, slowly looking around the circle, acknowledging each of us individually. "Who here has pictured his or her own death?" he asked quietly. There was silence, then a few nervous chuckles. Then a couple of hands rose tentatively. "Not mine." He went on. "How can we expect to help our patients plan for their deaths if we haven't planned for ours?" He waited, not so much for a response, but for his words to sink in. The room was quiet, but Dr. Levy seemed to expect it. "I'd like us to do an exercise where we picture our own deaths," he said. "Who would be there? What would they be saying? Who would be crying? What would you have not gotten done? For what would you be grateful? Who would be holding your hand? Who would be standing at the foot of the bed? In the hall?" And with those instructions, he fell silent and closed his eyes. And so did we. I realized that although I was around death every day, I had never before allowed myself to consider my own. It was as if I had willed myself immune to it. But now I let it seep in. The sadness, the uncompleted tasks, the things I would miss, the weddings, the grandchildren I might never meet or see graduate. I saw my children crying. I saw their kids growing up without knowing me. I imagined my husband remarried, a new wife living in my house, stepmother to my children, grandmother to my grandchildren. But then I began to consider whom I would want to be next to me and what I would say to them, the words of encouragement, the instructions I would give them. I imagined the unknown, which may not be all that bad. And the tears started to fall down my cheeks. One big fat one at first, brimming over and paving a salty track down my dry cheek to come to an embarrassing stop at the corner of my mouth. I wasn't sure if I should lick it or ignore it. And thus my mindfulness exercise ended because I needed all of my focus to suppress my impending sobbing. I was relieved when Dr. Levy took in a deep breath and rang a bell, concluding the meditation. I'd been saved from the mortification of being an ICU physician sobbing uncontrollably as I pondered my own death, right in front of the nurses, physical therapists, and respiratory therapists that I feel I must stand before confidently, never wavering in my resolve that I can make it right for my patient. In all my years of practice, it was the first time I had truly faced my own death. It's not that there hadn't been opportunity. Every year at the Rosh Hashanah service, I read aloud the prayer Unatana Tokef, "Let us seed power." This prayer attests to our lack of control over our mortality, willing us to repent and mend our ways in order to be inscribed in the book of life for another year. Its words are sobering, even grisly. On Rosh Hashanah it is inscribed, and on Yom Kippur it is sealed. How many shall pass on, and how many shall be born? Who shall live, and who shall die? Who in his time, and who before his time? Who by fire, and who by water? Who by sword, and who by beast? Who by hunger, and who by thirst? Who by storm, and who by plague? who by choking and who by stoning? Who shall rest and who shall wander? Who shall be tranquil and who shall be harassed? Who shall be at peace and who shall suffer? Who shall become poor and who shall become rich? Who shall fall and who shall rise?
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is Dr. Jessica Zitter, whose book is Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
But somehow it never felt real, these types of deaths, by stoning, drowning, thirst, sword. They felt strange, ancient, more of an attestation to ritual than to reality. They had nothing to do with me. But sitting in that circle, I finally let it in, the hard fact of my mortality. Opening to the sadness, I realized I'd been running away from it. I began to think more deeply about how I would help all of those walking that path before me. How could I possibly help my patients accept their deaths if I hadn't stopped to accept mine? I am, of course, no different from my patients, no better or worse, and often no wiser, and no more entitled to live another day. I reminded myself that death comes for us all, and sooner or later, I will be the one in that bed on the other end of the stethoscope. I considered what type of doctor I would want to have with me as I made these final decisions, as I breathed my final breaths. It would be one who would strive to know who I was and what was most important to me, one who would counsel my family members if I could not speak for myself, who would alleviate my suffering, make sure I never felt abandoned or scared, that all of the pieces were in place, and then allow me to pass peacefully into that good night. Makes me sad. I opened my eyes and I took a deep breath. I had my work cut out for me. Thank you. So I think, are we going to do a Q&A?
Hi, Dr. Zitter. Has there been any research or work done to categorize or list the conditions in different situations at which point the patient is dying and starting dialysis or inserting a permanent ventilation system is hindering death and wasting resources and inflicting pain? I mean, are there sets of, you know, your chemicals are in this disorder and your blood pressure is like this and your organs are falling apart?
It's an excellent question. And I will tell you, and I know Dr. Bargava is here and there's probably other physicians in the room, the reality about physiology and medical disease and cancer and all sorts of things is that there's still a lot of uncertainty in everything. There just is. I mean, we get surprised by things sometimes. Now, that's not to say that we don't have prognostication abilities. We doctors have a lot of experience, and we can tell when we think someone's dying. But the problem is that when there's any amount of uncertainty, many of us, and this is a big obstacle to communicating difficult news to people, we stand and say, we don't have 100% certainty, and who are we to give up? And so we then keep mum about what we think is going on because we're afraid of the uncertainty and we don't want to take away hope. It's all with the best of intention. What's important is for us to be forthright with what we think is likely to happen and acknowledge uncertainty at the same time, which is very hard, I think, for many doctors. It's certainly hard for me. There are conditions which are more likely to result in death sooner than later, and our experience can guide people, but we can sometimes be wrong. It's not often. In fact, when I was writing my book, I sent an email out to a lot of, in fact, I probably asked you, Dr. Bhargava, a lot of my ICU friends, I said, how many times have you had a case where you were really confident that they were going to do badly, and they ended up not doing as badly as you thought? And it was rare. It was rare. We've got, when you were really sure as a doctor, like, this person's going to die very soon, and it didn't happen that way, it's rare. But it does happen, and that kind of experience can make doctors, again, reticent to give you the information that they're thinking, because that kind of experience makes us feel like, oh my gosh, you know, I was wrong, which is not a good thing to feel as a doctor, or I could have taken this person's life away. So I'm babbling, but the main take-home point that I want to make for your question is this. There's a lot of uncertainty. There are a lot of different personal preferences and values that you will have. So each person might respond to the uncertainty in a different way and say, well, I'm willing to take this risk or not willing to take it. And it ultimately has to come down to a conversation about what we think is going to happen, what our experience tells us is going to happen, about the fact that there's uncertainty, and pulling your preferences and values into it and seeing what risks you're willing to take or not. There's a long-winded answer, but...
Carl-Larry, so in the film, Extremis, it sounds like there are some situations where the patient is minimally responsive, mm-hmm. and certain deteriorations have already occurred. Mm-hmm. It seems like you're sure that it's... That the ventilation is, I guess, is something I'm really concerned about.
Yeah,
it is going to result in death. Maybe it's not in 2 days, but maybe it's in 6 weeks. But nothing has changed in between.
In other words, putting the ventilator in is not going to change the fact that this person is on a path towards dying.
Rises, like,
right.
Like
there's not going to be a cure to the thing that's happening. Right. Those are situations we can usually tell you. And by the way, that case in Extremis, if any of you have watched it, I'm not sure, Dr. Bhargava is in Extremis as well, by the way. And she and I were taking care of that patient together. And that was a case for me, one of the rare cases where someone actually lived longer than I expected. Much longer than I expected. I don't know if you would agree with that. She agrees. That was a case that woman had such serious damage to her brain that was shocking to us all that she lived almost 6 months after that in a very minimally conscious state. But nonetheless, it was one of those shocking cases, which are rare. She never regained full consciousness, but she kind of would do this roving thing with her eyes. And the question is ultimately, her daughter was making decisions for her, but maybe that was the right outcome. I don't know. I mean, ultimately, you hope that the decision process that happens is something that's healthy, psychologically healthy, that has good communication skills, and that there isn't polarization going on between the family. And I'll talk to you more about it offline, but it's complicated stuff. It just requires tons of communication and tons of relationship building, ultimately. Compassion.
Thanks.
Yes, compassion, absolutely.
Thank you very much. I feel I'm not a health professional or a physician, but I feel very much in tune with the things you spoke about as a professional in medicine, as also the Jewish values that you discussed. It also reminded me, I'm forgetting the name of the book by the doctor.
Oh, Being Mortal?
Yeah, Being Mortal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Some of those sentiments,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, because I went to a presentation this morning, how someone like yourself might characterize the encounter between these values, including that we shouldn't hinder the process of dying, with this technology, they called it redefining death, where cryonics do life extension and back dying. How would you characterize the encounter of those two very different,
cryonics is an extreme example of, personally, I think it's very far-fetched, but it's an extreme example of what is actually truly happening with some benefit in our healthcare. You know, we've got these new therapies that since 2012-13, targeted chemotherapy, that sometimes, shockingly, can give us a real improvement in a patient that we are sure is going to die. It's actually thrown some of us, you know, who are interested in the idea of prognostication off of our game a little bit. Like, whoa, you know, this targeted chemotherapy can take someone who looks like they're about to die and actually give them a little bit of a reprieve for a couple of years. So that can be shocking. But I think that you have to keep all of those advancements where you have, again, outlier. Those are outlier cases, by the way, who do that well with targeted chemotherapy. Or people who do well on something called ECMO. If you're interested, we have a podcast called The Magic Machine, which is about using a certain type of cardiopulmonary support that kept somebody alive in this crazy way that was, again, way off the bell curve. These things are still very, very rare. And the problem with us is that we take rare, rare outliers, which are wonderful things, and we ascribe them to ourselves. We think we're going to benefit the same way, when again, it's still a minority of people who will actually benefit from it. And that's what I see the cryonics movement doing. They're just like, well, let's just wait until something great comes up. And who knows? Maybe, you know, I didn't expect targeted chemotherapy to come along. But again, you got to be realistic. Like Jacob, you've got to be real. You've got to face the fact that you can sit and hope and pray that somehow you'll be saved and live forever or live till you're 150. But it's not realistic in terms of likelihood that, you know, even if you have a response to targeted chemotherapy, it gives you maybe another couple of years. It's not like it's this, you know. Yeah. So everything has to be kept in context. And I find that movement to be a little bit far-fetched right now, but who's to say?
The segment of your philosophy that you have presented to us included in the curriculum of medical schools?
Good question. not yet. Well, some places are doing a lot of things, but are you talking about my specific stuff that I'm talking about? No. There is encouragingly more and more effort being put into teaching communication skills in medical school and nursing school and other types of schools, to teaching, to having the support of the palliative care team, to teaching people about what palliative care is so that they will utilize that. One of our biggest champions is Dr. Bhargava. Thank you very much. To really bring palliative care into the mainstream. Palliative care is a relatively new subspecialty, number one. And number two, it's a new subspecialty that many of us, including how I used to feel, can think of as, oh, it's the touchy-feely people. It's somehow less, because it's less technological, it's less shiny, it's less interventionalist, we devalue it in the medical world. And people like Dr. Bhargava are really saying, well, wait a minute, no, I'm seeing the value, and she's 10 years behind me, following in my footsteps before her, kind of coming along and really bringing palliative care into the intensive care unit. Thank you. It's happening. It's slowly, there is culture change happening. It's two steps forward and one step back. And it is very, it still can be very demoralizing to be trying to practice this kind of healthcare. It's still hard. We have a long way to go. Some institutions are better than other institutions. Some medical schools are better than other medical schools. And it's going to be a process. It's going to be a process. Yes.
Just to continue on that subject, I recently dealt with my mom dying 2 years ago in Florida in a nursing home. Mm-hmm. And she was put on hospice care after many years of being ill. And it was her decision. She had enough hospitals. That was it. She didn't want to go to another hospital. Mm-hmm. To my dismay, what I found out was that palliative care is a very young industry. And believe me, it's an industry.
It is an industry.
And oh, hospice, yes, if it's for profit, is owned by Roto-Rooter or some other
Roto-Rooter company. It is owned by Roto-Rooter. Yeah. Yes, you are right.
Which I didn't know about, and yes. I come from a social services background, so I was shocked. I thought, I can handle
very
this.
Disturbing.
I could not handle it, and I deal with this all the time, and I couldn't handle it. Even the rabbi that came in was an employee of the hospice. My mom, the expression I used was conveyor belt. Exactly what you're talking about outside of palliative care. So believe me, it has a long way to go. And unfortunately, we couldn't turn to them. And my mom and I ended up developing a secret relationship underground, away from the hospice care, so that we could communicate. Oh. It was really kind of crazy.
I'm so sorry to hear that. And I want to tell you something. I'm writing a piece about this right now.
Oh, great.
About my disappointment. And I shouldn't be saying it in public because I want to have context to it.
Yes.
I still think hospice is the best that we have.
Yes.
And I think there are a lot of fly-by-night hospices that have arisen that are for-profit that don't have the deep compassion and conviction. And it's really problematic. And I'm very disturbed by it myself. So I'm 100% with you. I might actually want your card so that I can call you about it.
Yeah.
Because I'm writing about this right now.
Okay,
I'm very disturbed about it too.
Great.
Okay. Yeah. Dr. Bargava. Oh, goodness.
Hi, Jess.
So hi.
Jess is my colleague at Highland. And I wanted to talk to you. One thing we've talked about a lot is how the healthcare system is a for-profit system. Physicians are paid for how many patients they see per day and how corrosive that is to actually spending meaningful time with each patient. Do you see these changes viably happening in our healthcare system as long as profit is the metric?
Couldn't have said it better myself. You and I both have chosen to work in public hospitals where we don't personally benefit from the number of procedures that we do. And we don't, you know, we are really in a way sort of like Kaiser also, which is a capitated system. We are really there to try to do the best that we can, but we're still a part of that system that exists all around us where every chemotherapy, you know, someone gets paid. That's why they joke. I mean, it's horrible, but about chemotherapists, you know, you have to like screw down the coffin. They will do it until the American Society of Clinical Oncology says giving someone chemotherapy within 2 weeks of their death is an indicator of bad quality of care. And it is so prevalent. We see it all the time. So it's absolutely true that until we start, you know, changing the profit sort of orientation and the infrastructure around the whole for-profit picture and getting out of this whole fee-for-service world, it's going to be very hard. There are workarounds for it, and Medicare is doing several demonstration projects to try and start to do sort of more pay-for-performance types of approaches where it's not about you're only going to get paid if you show good quality outcomes, which include quality of death, quality, you know, et cetera, and not overuse of chemotherapy at the end of life, et cetera. So the hope is that we're starting to move in that direction, but we have got a long way to go. And you're right that the profit incentive is really going to be, talk about hindrance, a hindrance to a good approach to this problem. It's really problematic.
I think that was the last question. I hope so, because time is up. And let's thank our wonderful speaker.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Dr. Jessica Zitter, whose book is Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Dan Folds, and Alex Espalay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pamantuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.